Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and I'm not here today. This episode is just Andy and Duncan talking. If you remember, Duncan couldn't be here for our podcast on Read or Die, the spotlight anime for the previous episode. And so he and Andy hashed it out for roughly an hour to get Duncan's unique perspective. I'll just hand it over to them. You go ahead and enjoy.
Well, we're back, this time with good old Duncan, who's going to be able to... Wait, your name's not Duncan, is it?
No, it is. You got that right, and the fact that I'm old, but I'm not sure if I'm necessarily any good. So two out of three.
Shit, I messed up the intro.
This is perfectly shambolic.
Yes! Perfect, just what I need. Perfect for me. So, unfortunately, Duncan couldn't make it to the live show because he had a massive power cut, which fucking blew, as Duncan has some genuinely different opinions from the rest of us, which I'm sure, as you've just heard, we pretty much liked it, all of it, and we didn't have much problems with this show, but you have been telling us how much you... didn't enjoy it, so we really wanted you to share us your opinion.
I mean, it's not necessarily that I didn't enjoy moments. I think that it's sort of pedal spectacle, that it's all about just, oh, look, it's a man on a giant mechanical locust. Oh!
Yeah. I know exactly. It's like style over substance.
But it's not even necessarily style. Style requires a sort of coherent vision. It's like the guy has this idea. We're like, ooh, that would be cool. I'll do that. And he just keeps following that chain of thought. It's like, ooh, that'd be cool. I'll do that. And then I'll do that. Yeah. With no sort of editorial or self-imposed filter on whether those things are good. It's just like, yeah, that's weird, strange, steampunk mix of stuff. Why not? Let's go with it.
It feels, you know what it feels? It feels, I know exactly what you mean, it's like very Hollywood. It's very like, I can equate this a lot to Fast and the Furious series, which, I mean, bizarrely, that's of all of them I kind of have seen, and it's all terrible, but it's very much like, It doesn't make sense how these people are good at the thing that they're doing right now. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all fantastical, sort of like fantasy, Hollywood, like crazy violence, magic bullshit that doesn't really work.
I mean, there's the two sort of touchstones I have for it are there's a sort of semi-notorious Will Smith vehicle called the Wild Wild West.
A very well known vehicle. Yeah. Like Wild Wild West is sort of, I mean,
it's a meme. It's so well known because it's so bad. but the thing is, it was bad, but it was memorable. And perhaps that's the compliment I would pay to this.
Robot Spider, right?
Yeah, exactly. Giant robots, bugs everywhere, flying machines, which really shouldn't be flying. I don't know.
Isn't one of the plot points in Wild Wild West that they've put a light through someone's eye and that's the last thing they see, but it's upside down?
I think that's correct. But that's been used in a few things. That has been used in... I'm sure it was used in one of the Sherlock Holmes films, but I could be wrong.
What, the light through the eye thing?
Yeah, definitely a common myth.
That was the first time I'd heard of it. And then I was like, that's cool. I wonder if it's true. And then I just stop for a minute and be like, no, of course it's fucking bullshit.
No, I think it's definitely one of those myths which people believed for a long time. And I've definitely seen it in other places. I think this is almost like the inverse of something like the... it's like, there's been a lot of talk about people who follow anime about how Hollywood, when it has chose to crib from it or adapt it to whole scale like it has with Ghost in the Shell, sort of just cherry picks what it thinks are the interesting visual things and just places them almost in isolation without thought of how they come together. And this was very much that. It's like, from the word go, the title sequence, to me it was just like really it was like a typical spy thriller title sequence, but
yes.
It was randomly interrupted by shots of half-naked women. But
they were like, but they had like painted on the credits were painted on their bodies in like sort of like a naked art sort of stylistic like kind of way.
James Bond is obviously like what they're sort of cribbing from then. And a big part of those films is there's always a love interest, there's always seduction going on. There's nothing in this which it would make those remotely related to it, unless there's a version of this which is heavy on the fan service, which we never saw. But
yeah,
I mean, apart from obviously Nancy's giant boob window, I mean, that costume choice is pretty terrible. But
it is very bad. But then also, she's kind of like the trophy wife of the evil guy.
Did any of you guys notice that they gave away the sort of only plot twist it has in the title sequence?
No, I don't remember.
So there's a shot of Nancy. The first shot you see Nancy in is she shoots through a window and you see into a room and there's another Nancy standing there who runs away.
Wow, I didn't notice that. I thought that was she shot through the window. There was a cut of a guy moving away
It's two Nancys.
Is it really her?
I'm pretty sure.
I didn't notice that. I thought it was a guy that he shot away.
We can pause this here and I can confirm.
I'll take your word for it, man. Like,
but no, that was like, I was like, is that deliberate or is that like, because it's like you, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, that's a interesting little idea about what spycraft is. And then it turns out later to be literally what's going on.
I mean, that also, like, that rings true with a lot of anime openings. Like, can't think, like, loads of them have spoilers in that you wouldn't know unless you've read the manga.
That is actually true. I wonder why that happens. I mean, I suppose it's because the opening has to stay relevant for a full series, but in this case, it's an OVA, so it doesn't really have that excuse.
I think it's that, but then also that for people who have already watched it and are already fans, like, they're excited to know what's happening next because they know what's going to be in it. So, like, the example that I can think of off the top of my head, I'm sure there are better ones, but like Shokugeki no Soma, like season 2 had that beginning intro fight, and it was kind of a boring opening actually. I didn't really like it as much as the first season's ones, but it definitely had those openings where it was showing, in a very clever way, it was showing the two people who are fighting up against each other, and it was like, and then, you know, you had like Soma and the Spice guy, you had like Alice and God, who did she fight against? Well, anyway, but you wouldn't have clocked that that's what was going on unless you were a fan, and then you're like, oh sweet, so they're going to do that fight and they're going to do that fight and they're going to do that fight, and that would excite you to sort of see it, if that makes sense.
In the case of that series, it's essentially following standard sort of shonen battle of the week formulas, but with cooking.
Totally.
And so there's that, the fact that they end up fighting each other isn't so much of a spoiler. It's just, rather than this person has an evil clone.
Yeah, or if you want to delve in deeper, then you got like JoJo as well. Like,
oh, yeah, JoJo.
A lot of JoJo.
Yeah, JoJo does it.
JoJo spoils a lot of stuff in that opening, especially season 3, especially season 1. Season 1, it starts off with it flicking through every JoJo in the manga. Like, it starts off with 1, goes all the way to 8.
I mean, that's an interesting thing that it does in that particular series, because it's almost like they've done an OVA of it before, which was obviously an incomplete and sort of out of chronology one, and sort of like putting that shot at the start of that sort of acknowledges that and sort of makes a promise to its audience that we're actually going to do the full thing.
Yeah, we're going to do it justice, this guys, even if by season 4 it kind of looks like garbage.
Yeah, they're going to make their way through whatever happens.
I'm fucking excited. I really hope they do, because season 5 is my favourite. Arc 5 is my favourite. Stone Ocean. But it's the dumbest one. But yeah, so I know what you mean by that. And I also know what, like, because there is a weird mishmash of like themes and stars. And this is the one thing I did mention, how like We have in one shot, in one room, we have the Thunderbird's headlight, eye lights go on where they have a conversation. They then pick up an old phone. They then put it into like a bank of terminals which look like Turing machines. Mm-hmm. And then he opens up a TV screen to get a live recording, and then he gets an email on another TV screen. And you're like, what is going... It very much is rule of the cool.
Yeah, there was definitely a sort of... a knowledge of this thing called a steampunk aesthetic. It was not necessarily any, at least in what we saw, any reasoning behind why that steampunk aesthetic should exist.
No, and like the reason why I forgave it for that was because this is an OVA of a series that I know nothing about. Mm. I didn't know whether that was a thing that was mentioned in the series, but they didn't have the time to mention in the actual show.
I mean, while that's true, this preceded its TV appearance. So this was the first animated version of it which happened. And so I think it doesn't really get an excuse for not giving characters a good introduction as to the whys of the world. It was very much of just bonkers stuff happening without a where's or a why. It's like
but you can level that the same with, I mean, if we're going back to JoJo, we might as well, like, JoJo the first OVA arc was the second half of part three.
And I would level that to it was ridiculous and it was stupid, and that the second time they did it was the correct way to do it. And therefore I will say this is silly.
I agree, but they're not doing it for the general audience, they're doing it for the fans, they're doing it for the people who've already read the is it a light novel or
a
manga?
I believe it's a light novel. So is that something you'd say is part of the expectation for an OVA, that they're not necessarily designed for a broadcast audience, they're designed for a very small, already invested audience who'll come in knowing what they're going to get?
I think for the time that it was made, yes.
Okay.
Like, this is a fairly old anime, I think.
2001, I think.
I believe that is actually kind of about the cusp of that sort of thing, where if it isn't like a direct OVA, you've got these specific OVAs which were done just for the fans.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, I think 2000 odd was probably about the last time that they would do something like this. I can't think of something in recent memory.
The only thing I can think of was that Rakugo started as an OVA, which was bonus with one of their the print version. So there was like what we saw as an extra long first episode actually started out as an OVA, and then
sure, but that was bundled with a book.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So like, do we know if this was like, okay, we've just put out the new season and we're also putting out this OVA?
I believe that this OVA was standalone in that. Mm. It wasn't bundled with a book like Rakugo was.
Yeah. So there'll quite often be an assumed knowledge that...
Yeah.
All the weird things like, what exactly is an Aijin? This weird selection of villains they keep throwing at us without any explanation of what one is.
Well, that was a brief explanation. I agree it wasn't like... it wasn't to a standard that I think we would probably hold in modern anime, especially like the longer series stuff.
Mm.
But yeah, no, they didn't really explain Aijin. They didn't really explain why the president kept pissing his pants.
Yeah, he was just like, okay, the president's cowardly. That's his character trait. Let's just run with it. That opening sequence, am I wrong thinking that they directly cribbed the explosion from Independence Day?
Yes, no, we did mention
was
that.
Was it shot for shot the that, same, yeah, or was it just similar? So I was like, did they actually just recreate that deliberately as just like a weird in reference, which would make me feel more fond of it? I mean, that sort of first sequence was then immediately followed. I mean, there was the bits I liked most of it were sometimes the quieter bits, like Yamako in her room, or just sort of waking up, sort of half awake and just sort of rummaging through this room full of books for her phone, and sort of like and those sections,
like opening that book like in the beginning to find the money and be like, oh, there it is, and grabbing that.
Yeah. Like that's her filing system. She keeps things in books rather than in drawers. And it felt like that almost was a different animation style from some of the later stuff as well. I mean, that may have just been how it worked out, but it was a lot more, I don't know, subdued. It was almost like a bit rotoscopy at times. I know we've had our discussions over what constitutes rotoscoping in the past, but it was like when they're doing the traditional character animation, you have shapes, and then it's difficult to describe, but it's like it was more, the shapes were more amorphous. It wasn't quite
clear
a constructed character. It was more a series of lines which happened to be this character.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, they focus more on the fluidity of the movement rather than the detailing of the character.
Yeah.
Ping Pong is an excellent example for this. Lots of Ping Pong was rotoscoped, especially that opening, that gorgeous opening.
Yeah, Ping Pong has one of the best openings of all time, I think.
Oh, but God, it's fucking incredible. I absolutely love that opening.
What was the general opinion on the characters? Because I thought it was basically, apart from Nancy and Yamako, there was pretty much nothing to any of them. Was that?
Didn't really broach it, but yeah, I agree. There was like the gun guy was just a guy with a gun,
he
and he didn't
terrible.
Even shoot. He's awful.
What I would compare him to was basically a henchman in an Austin Powers film. It's like he had to keep loudly mentioning his daughter. It was like, oh dear, I this is a tough situation. If I don't make it out of here, my poor old daughter's not going to get her birthday present.
Remember, I have a sob story too. Oh ho ho.
You should be worried about me, please.
Yeah. Like just instantly raising death flags, like left, right, and centre. Like, oh, okay, yeah, we now care about you.
This may just be my sort of the way I hear voices, and perhaps I haven't heard enough bad early era anime for this to be something I've got over. But there was like when they repeatedly shouted Yamako's her spy name. It was Zapepa!
Zapepa!
It was just terrible. It was just like, it was completely immersion breaking every time. It was like, oh, I'm watching this, and then suddenly, Zapepa!
Zapepa! Mr. Deep!
Yeah.
But then Drake Anderson was just Drake Anderson. And you're just like,
it's like the only person who I thought actually managed to say that code name with any sort of non-farcicalness was Nancy's actress, and I don't know, I thought in terms of the performances, the central two were actually okay. What was the opinion on that? Was that
I like their central performances were okay. It looks, for what it's worth, the voice actress of Nancy is a pretty big seiyuu, even at the time that it was created, starting in like 1988. So she's an old hat. And it looks like she's still going. Okay. Yeah, she's done loads of shit.
I think remembering that now, Gorm mentioned that she started off playing young seductresses, and now she's graduated to old seductresses.
That doesn't surprise me. And likewise with I actually found some of the voices, maybe it was just my audio channel, but it felt like weirdly muted. Did that feel like that to you?
I'm not sure how the mix was. You could well be right, but I think they had bigger gripes, so it was like that would be a relatively minor gripe for me rather than the stuff which the general disjointedness. What was your, I mean, to go with the weird shouting of da paper.
Da paper!
Indeed. Yeah, sorry. We had the theme tune, which maybe just the British thing, but I know it was supposed to be sounding like sirens, but it sounded exactly like the tone you get when you leave the phone off the hook for too long. It's just it's just this obviously artificial whine. And I assume they were trying to evoke sirens, but because it was such an constructed one and such an artificial one, it sort of just sounded like this annoying noise going off.
Yeah, again, they were certainly trying to evoke like old cartoon, old like cop dramas and sort of like spy thrillers and all that kind of stuff. Which was, I felt very evident. But I don't think that was necessarily a bad thing. Like,
well, it's like the title sequence itself. It's like evoking things without understanding them. It's like a very, this idea that you have like you'll have the person who, the original creator of an idea, and then you'll have his pupil, and then you'll have their pupil, and somewhere down the line you get someone who understands the surface of an idea, but has absolutely no idea where that came from. And I feel like this is where this guy was, that he had like all these things he thought was cool, but he had no idea why they had come to being like they were.
It felt very superficial in a way.
The dialogue, it reminded me a bit of the famous Harrison Ford quote. He famously once said to George Lucas, "George, you can type the shit, but you can't say it." And this may just be reading subs for what was actually quite good dialogue, but the way it sounded, that's all I have to work on, because obviously I don't have work in Japanese, but the subs made it sound like he was not the greatest of all. It's like it was all quite lore heavy and quite jargony without ever sounding like something which a conversation two actual people would be having.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It feels very, like, I think I mentioned the Chunibyo syndrome. I feel this is sort of kind of similar. Yeah, like, it does feel very, like, inorganic in a way. And even at the end, I didn't really understand. Like, I didn't understand how Nancy got off the spaceship.
So it was, she's visiting Nancy's clone, not Nancy.
What? Oh, so Nancy's up in space?
Yeah, Nancy's dead in space, and that's why she talks about her older sister.
That went over my head too.
There you go.
I thought she'd gone back. Wow.
No,
it's
the clone Nancy. It's the young Nancy. The one who was left behind by us. Because they talk about oxygen deprivation, which is like a bit of a red herring, because the younger one is drowned by the older one.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's how she's picked up by the crew afterwards. That's why we see Yomiko going to talk to her and saying, "Oh, your older sister was this great person and saved everyone by doing this and that and the other."
And I mean, I know what you mean by sort of like going back to problems with the show. I kind of know what you mean by the fantastical about it, because even though there are all these like machinery parts, and especially that giant fortress at the end, like there are lots of shots of like machinery moving and parts moving and it all moving around, but it never felt like it had much weight to it.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few bits where I think they got things right, but there was a sort of curious ethereal quality to a lot of it, where things like the giant metal, the bird jet, which I actually quite liked little bits of its design, didn't move like something created out of metal wood. It was behaving like something far lighter than it looked. It looks like this thing cobbled together through metallurgy and weird little bits of 19th century science, but it moves like this incredibly fast fighter jet, pulling off incredibly agile maneuvers. Obviously, there's supposed to be an incredible element to all these people, like the Monkey King in particular. I think the second episode where we get him is the one I actually enjoyed the most, because they just sort of went with it. Like, I enjoyed the parting of the river and his weird his pole, his
the monkey pole.
Yeah, and the fact that he takes it and hits a nuclear submarine is quite enjoyable.
I mean, I think that was like my biggest that episode was like my biggest problem, because like that was the really sort of like bullshit thing where the sub just happened to be in the right place to launch a missile, which is only like an underwater missile should really be able to launch. Like, that doesn't really work in any sense of context.
I think that they did try and give some plausibility by that, by saying, okay, you have to get him close enough for this to reach him. But I think this is just because I was listening to another podcast talk about Hunt for Red October a week or so ago. Torpedoes don't arm if they're too close to the the sub. So that sort sub. Of... Unless he... I don't know. Who knows? Maybe there was some little bit of dialogue saying, oh, taking the... arming the torpedoes and so on and so forth. But who knows? It's like...
I don't think so. I think, again, it's that sort of like Hollywood, hey, it works, so it works. You know?
These are heroes, therefore it works.
Yeah.
It's like weirdly, it also had, that sequence had my weird favourite little bit of animation, which is the Monkey King's corpse falling. Just like this one weird little bit of ragdoll physics. It was almost like he just collapses onto this stone and it's a proper belly flop, and it's just like,
bleh. Yeah.
And I just quite like it. It's just like this. A strange, consider as you're saying, there's this very weird lightness and lack of physicality to the animation in a lot of parts, and this was this one part where he had stopped being this. You'd say it's being smart in this way. He'd gone from being this this idea of what he was, this. This real world representation of a character from myth to being what he actually was, which was just a piece of meat. And you could say that's like an actual smart transition to make, from him being this weightless, capable, incredible feats to just this thing hitting a slab. But I'm not sure I want to believe they were being quite that clever. It's like they fought. There's like they treated him quite harshly, because the follow up is him getting a stave through the head and then his body crushed underneath a huge wave.
He certainly, out of all of them, gets the unluckiest death. Yeah. Like, so most of them just get like we just like blow up or whatever. But he properly got it.
I mean, one of the things we talk about with animation, and as its strength of a medium, is doing things you couldn't do otherwise. And there was some things like when the river collapses back in after being parted, which was actually where they did a really good job of getting it to do the water behaving like you would think water would behave in that situation.
Yeah, agreed.
It's weirdly, as you say, the mechanical bits were often the bits which didn't behave like you felt they would.
Like, no, that scene when they're destroying all the underground or the submerged or unsubmerged city, ruined city. That was really cool. But then that was then followed up with a bit where they all run into like a side hatch on a submarine.
Yeah, that was what I think was happening is the sub was on its side, so that was actually like
the top.
Yeah, possibly. But I could be wrong there. But that was my assumption. I think that second episode was definitely the one I felt I enjoyed the most, perhaps just because it had the most ridiculous villain and most gave itself most over to embracing the silliness, whereas the first and the last one both were a bit too in love with their own drama to actually be for me to take its intention seriously. It's like you're looking silly but you're acting serious, whereas in the second episode you're looking silly and you're acting silly, and it's also
got like a very very stylized place and setting, which it felt like to me they took a lot of care in sort of realizing and trying to be accurate to that to where it was, and then also you had like that nice bit where they're in the dark and you had the flashlight nicely panning across stuff, which I thought worked really well in its favor for that episode, and then but that's like the last you see of like a really real location, and then you go off to Fantasy Mech Fortress.
Yeah. I mean, the Mech Fortress was. I mean, they obviously were sort of riffing on the idea of like big oil rigs, or combined with sort of steam stations. The way they killed the electric guy with the huge coolant pipe. There's this scene in Akira where Tetsuo has gone down to the storage facility and is sort of trying to break his way through all the layers of containment to where the chamber where Akira is stored, and you see the sort of chamber rising up and all the coolant pipes just sort of flying off and snaking and all these the sort of all this pressure from within in them going out. And yet when this happens when you get this huge, like many meters across pipe full of hyper-pressurized cold hydrogen or whatever punctured, all it does is just spray this little thing down, and there's very little movement in the pipe at all. It's like...
And that's also it. It does its like one jet stream and then it goes. It's like, oh, we
sealed
it off now.
We self-sealed. It's wonderful technology we've had. Don't worry.
Mech technology.
But yeah, it's just quite a strange one, and all in all that it's managed to remain as incoherent as it did, because normally these things will sort of pull themselves into some sense of coherence after a while, but this never felt like it did to me. As you say, it almost got more incoherent as the time went on. It had this, wanted us to feel emotions it never really earned. Was there any particular scene you guys liked as favourites? Because I know what mine was, and it was just like a random little one, but it's...
My favourite, I really enjoyed scene at the one of the first scenes, like when you don't really know enough about the world, and then you're getting like these shots of modern Tokyo as she's looking for books, and then she sort of goes down this elevator and seems like a mall, and then you just go to this underground sort of like, all of a sudden, like the scenery changes, the atmosphere changes, the style changes completely from super modern to quite old fashioned looking.
That sort of reminded me of what happens in how the Harry Potter films handle the transition from their sort of contemporary setting to their magical setting.
I feel that actually is a good comparison. You got these two separate worlds and they don't really collide, but when they do, big trouble happens. But why are they colliding in the first place?
Yeah, like we have no idea. It's so hard to feel any care about a villain when you have so little idea of where he came from. It's okay, so you were this ancient monk, and now you're alive in the modern day with superpowers because...
Yeah, and then it's the same also at the end with, like, Nancy. I didn't really understand.
She's supposed to be Mata Hari, who was a spy in World War One, or an alleged spy anyway. She was a exotic dancer who allegedly spied for both the Germans and the French.
Huh, okay.
Played both sides against each other, which is obviously, when the character's revealed to be that person, then that obviously sort of gives, if you know who the historical figure was, then you obviously have this set of assumptions about her to work with, which is part of the problem for me, is that there are several characters who I don't know much about. But yeah, the actual my sort of favourite scene was when you have Nancy and Yomiko just sitting around in the sort of mini library / waiting room. I think it's at the end of the... It's either the beginning of the second episode or end of the first. I think it's the beginning of the second.
I think it's the beginning of the second episode, yeah.
And Nancy just sort of... it's almost like a spy sleepover or something where Yonka's just got her book and Nancy's just there braiding her hair and sort of just, hey, pay attention to me. No, I'm reading my book. It's like... it's like a nice little moment, and they managed to sell it in a way which didn't make it look too artificial, and because it was just like this small bit of movement rather than often the dialogue was almost people declaring stuff. It's, I am going to do this, this happened because of this, you are whatever, whereas this was just, I'm just going to mess around with your hair a bit. And it was just, it felt as natural rather than contrived. And I don't know. Mm.
It felt like out of all the ludicrousy that goes on, there is just one moment of sort of semblance and understanding and a touchstone that people can understand. Mm. It's like, these are two people who have spent a passage of time and they're bonding. And
there definitely wasn't much to make them relatable apart from that scene, and perhaps you can say the end scene as well. But...
Yeah, and I know what you mean by that end scene. Like, I didn't feel any emotion for that end scene.
Well, you didn't know what was going on, so that's
that's just like, how'd you get down from space, mate?
Yeah, you should be in space. What are you doing here?
The fuck.
I was thinking that I've completely lost my train of thought with that silliness. Where were we?
One thing I did notice real quick, I forgot to mention this, is all the enemies, as soon as someone picks up a gun that isn't a two-handed weapon, they always give it a gangster lean. Which is something that feels very 2001,
that's true.
The guns shoot fast if I put it to the side, right?
Yeah, and actually does remind me of what I was thinking of, which was Nancy's superpower. Now, obviously, Yomiko's superpower is the main focus of this idea that she can create weapons or whatever out of paper. And Nancy's one is that she can pass through things. Now, in terms of animation, those are both quite interesting superpowers to have. The paper one, because you can just form shapes at whatever shape you want, and you can make this thing take on whatever properties you want whenever you want, and so you can just, you have this perfect thing which can do whatever you want in terms of it's like this perfect subject for animation, this thing which can become whatever you want it to and can have whatever properties you want it to. But they didn't really do much with that. I mean, you get fairly mundane things, swords and shields, and I mean, the main sort of bit where she gets to show it off is like making the paper plane, which was I don't know if I liked it or not, because it's like, oh, this big sequence of all the paper sort of coming up from her suitcase, where she sort of keeps all her paper so she can... Actually, that was the other bit of character design. Like, the fact that she had this suitcase full of paper she just carried around with her, which made her look like an old granny, but was in fact a weapon. And it's like this sequence where she's making the plane, and it's all blooming out of the suitcase, and it's swirling around, and it's all this dramatic movement going on, and she's... All it's like, oh, what's she making? And it zooms out, and there's just this paper plane which looks like it's made by a 4-year-old. And it's like,
dumpy ass paper plane.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like Drake just hand to forehead. What the hell are you doing?
I mean, for a start, like, you're right, that animation sequence, I thought that animation sequence was one of the best of that first episode, like, when it all billowed out, and she made that plane. But I actually really enjoyed it when she, like, it felt to me like she's kind of new to her powers so much, in that she's not battle trained. She doesn't ever fight with a semblance of knowing really what she's doing. Or only knowing to defend on what feels like some sort of like pure instinct, rather than some actual sort of like training or combat training that she's put any effort into.
Yeah, she's definitely portrayed as an innocent. Which is weird for a secret agent, that you have. But that's an interesting character, an innocent special agent. It's an interesting idea.
A special agent that needs like a part-time job.
Yeah. it was her superpower, and Nancy's was also interesting, but for the sort of the opposite reason. Like Yamako's, you could do whatever, she could create whatever you wanted, which is means you get interesting objects to look at. But what Nancy's meant is that if you decide the camera's moving with her, then the camera now can actually do things which a normal camera can't. So obviously, when a film is being made and has an actual physical camera, you can't just dive it through a floor without a weird transition. But because you've given Nancy this ability to move through solid objects, you can also move the camera through solid objects, which occasionally, they weren't common, but it let them do some interesting things, like dropping directly through floors and the camera following them. And that was actually sort of interesting, that you ended up with this two heroines with quite well-suited to anime superpowers. It's like, I certainly wouldn't say, like, I know you and I both very much enjoy My Hero Academia. And
love it.
it had like one of the standout animation sequences of the year recently, with two particular hero superpowers.
Todoroki versus Midorima.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Fucking beautiful.
It was
up there with like Mob Psycho or like
it was
One Punch Man.
There was this huge sense of the forces and that the forces aren't just like when someone punches something really hard, it's not that just their hand starts to glow, it's that it moves the air around it and it does things to the what is around them and how they move, and it's these shock waves and this heat and light. It was like an amazing sequence, but
it was, and then also this sense of like chaos, like neither one of them really knew what going full pelt would create. And the only people who realized were the adults, who were like, shit, we gotta put a stop to this, and that's why the concrete bars came up.
Yeah, and it didn't actually end up making much of a difference.
I mean, it did in a way. Like,
who knows? We could have just ended up with a pair of smoking boots at the end if they hadn't gone up. We don't know. But I think if you look at that and you look at some of the supporting cast's superpowers, they're definitely not necessarily ones which adapt well to the screen. Like, some of them are just bits, they have to work hard to make them interesting. Whereas I think both Nancy and Yamako were fairly well chosen.
Agreed.
I'm not so sure about their antagonists. As I say, the Monkey King was the only one that I really enjoyed. I thought the guy and his grasshopper were pretty terrible. The gentleman in the
also bird, just like grasshoppers are a very well done trope now. Probably even then, I felt it was a very well done trope of anyway, especially in anime.
What else is, for example, what else has done giant?
Well,
I suppose.
Actually, you are true. Well, not maybe like, but insects in Japan are very big. Like, there's a lot of stuff.
Literally
and figuratively, like they're quite a popular thing. So, but sorry, I'm going off.
No, I mean, it's like one of the things was like, why have they chosen these particular historical figures? Like, supposedly the insect man is like one of the guys who first did a classification of insects, and so that's why he's riding a giant insect or whatever. And then you've got
Then why is that important?
Then you've got a sort of famous turn of the century airman, and then you've got Beethoven, and then you've got a famous mystic, then obviously the one which breaks it all is the Monkey King, because he isn't any historical figure. He's literally just a myth. He's a story. Yeah. So it's like this weird thing that you had historical figures, and then you have this non-existent person. And it's like, from what I thought I understood of it, is that they were all sort of clones of these historical figures, and so in that case, where does the Monkey King come from? Because he never existed. And so I didn't get that.
No, I didn't really get that too, but again, I personally kind of forgave it for it not making sense by purely the fact that it's an OVA of an already established series by that point. The light novels. I mean, the light novels started in 2000, so admittedly it had only been going a year.
That's a pretty quick adaptation, I imagine. Sounds it anyway.
At least it's something very early on in the series, but it's clearly like part of the show.
Yeah, that must have been produced pretty quickly as well.
I imagine so. I imagine it just like must have just been based off the pure popularity of the light novel that they were like, well, let's pop out some OVAs quickly. One last thing I was going to say also, you were mentioning how the artistic, like, they had cool powers, but they didn't really do much with the direction and stuff. I agree with you there as well, but I didn't think that really bothered me whilst watching. I think Ben mentioned that it was, the director isn't a very, like, renowned director. He hasn't done anything like stand out. In actual fact, it looks like the biggest thing he did do was the Read or Die OVA. Apart from like he's done some storyboards, some producing on bit things here and there, but nothing big, and certainly nothing actiony. So yeah, they could have done a lot more if they had a better more
experienced action director.
More experience, or maybe just someone who was more willing to sort of play with rules of direction, you would have had some more interesting shots for sure. Yeah. It seems like they've, like, I don't know how budgets really worked back then, but you know, you've got a pretty strong voice actress being one of the main characters.
It's like you have some bits, like, as you say, making of the paper plane, where the animation's pretty great. And then there's the scene which I mentioned as my standout bad moment, which is when electrical guy gets hit by the ice, and he just gets sort of a blue swipe transition going down in the character, and that's how we see that he's frozen. It's like someone's just poured a bucket. It's like ice is something you pour over someone, like blue paint. and the weird thing is, I think you said to me, is that when you actually look at that, him himself looks incredibly bad to our modern eyes, but the smoke around him, the sort of way they've represented this hyper cold liquid, is actually still really good. It still lingers and sort of breaks up in a really beautiful way. And it was this weird mix of, okay, we're going to put lots of effort into this part and none into this. And that was like, that's the whole thing for me. It was just so incoherent and so lacking in focus on what it wanted to do. It had a lot of possibility to do interesting things, and in moments it did, but I think that's why I can't really recommend it at all, because it, I mean, yeah, you'll get a few good moments of spectacle out of it, but really there's no actual story to care about there, and it's not consistent moment to moment enough to hold most people's attention, I think. But there you go.
I mean, yeah, I know what you mean. It feels very much like... I would recommend... For what it's worth, I would recommend it if people... I wouldn't recommend it for people to go out over... Like, I think there's better stuff there, for sure. But I totally know what you mean by... Like, it's... I don't think it's boring. I think it's very watchable. It's just... What you're watching is very much just like an action piece. Set piece, set piece, set piece, set piece. I'm not really watching it for the characters or the story, because, like you said, they're not really there and they're very condensed, or they don't really make much sense.
It's like you can't really, as you say, there's, as you say, a lot of set pieces coming up, and it was really the quality of those set pieces was what varied. It was that, and so that's why my interest waned and waxed so much, that there was these moments where I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. And then, like, 5 minutes of nothing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that in the end is my whole thing of it. That it's just one very uneven. And it could have been worse, could have been better.
Yeah. I don't know. I like I said, I enjoyed it, but I can totally see where you're coming from. And I think we should probably call it a wrap.
And that's about it. Remember, rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us at KeyFramesPod. Email us at keyframespodcast@gmail.com with any questions you have. And yeah, just tune into us next time. We've got some great stuff coming up. Thanks.